Atlantis.
Rising.
That's the name of the game.
Yep.
We did it.
We know that.
That's the only thing I know for sure.
It's the only thing I know for sure in this world.
Hello, everybody. You are listening to Limited Playtime, the board game podcast where we bring you board game reviews in 30 minutes or less.
Or the next episode is free.
I am Kyle Bolin.
And I am Jason Cavalieri.
And today we are looking at... Wait, no. It's coming out of the sea. It's rising, Jason.
What's rising, Kyle?
Atlantis is rising in Atlantis Rising 2nd Edition, the board game that we're talking about today.
Oh, I didn't realize this was the 2nd Edition.
It is actually the 2nd Edition. The 1st Edition is from 2012. I know literally nothing about that game other than it must be similar to this game, which is the one we've played. Right. Atlantis Rising 2nd Edition from 2019. Although, I guess it's not rising because the byline for Atlantis Rising on Board Game Geek is Atlantis is sinking.
Oh yeah, I never thought about
that. Can you work together to build your escape before it's lost? And which is true, Atlantis is sinking the whole time. Why didn't they call it Atlantis
yeah,
sinking?
Why didn't they call it Atlantis sinking?
It never rises, right? I mean, no. Like literally the goal of the game is to escape it.
Yeah, that's true. That's a complete misnomer.
Yeah, that's funny. Anyway, okay, let's talk about the who's and the what's and everything. It is designed by Galen Siskel, we think?
We think.
Yeah, Chiselle? We don't know. It is also designed by Brent Dickman, who did the solo design, it looks like. The art is by Vincent Dutre, who is always absolutely amazing. And the game is published by Elf Creek Games, plus four more. Plays between 1 and 7 players, which is a very wide range for players. We have played it at 3 and I've played it at 2 with my wife. They have very specific special rules for playing it solo or with only 2 people, and there was even some adjustments that we were supposed to make in the 3-player game that I don't remember making when we played it at Gen Con. So I'm not sure we played it correctly, Jason, but I think we were close enough, right? And it has a playing time of 60 to 120 minutes and a weight of 2.44 out of 5.
Yeah, sounds about accurate.
Pretty much, yeah. So Atlantis Rising, as I said before, is a game where thematically you are the civilization of Atlantis, and Atlantis is sinking, as it did in mythology. And as a civilization, you are tasked with creating an apparatus, a machine, that will basically create a portal for all of the inhabitants of Atlantis to jump through and escape. So the point is to try to save the people of Atlantis, and you do so by crafting 9 different components to a big machine, and there's a big round board that they all kind of slot into as you make them. And then after you do all of that, after you do the 9 components, you can then make the centerpiece that requires like so many of, you know, the resources that are available in the game. And if you do that before Atlantis completely sinks into the ocean, you win the game. And it's cooperative, and it's a worker placement game, which is the thing I think is particularly special about this game. It's a worker placement co-op game, which is something that I had not played to my memory until I had played Atlantis Rising. Have you played any other worker placement games that are cooperative, Jason?
I'm trying really hard to think of one, and I can't.
In general, co-op Euro games are very rare, right?
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, unless you're counting things like Pandemic as a Euro game, and I'm not. I'm thinking about like traditional Euro mechanics, like worker placement. Yeah. Worker placement and action selection are the same thing, but like the sort of like resource engine building games, right? Like those tend to not be cooperative. Those tend to be competitive.
Yeah.
And those sort of like traditional Euro game mechanics tend to be in competitive games and not in cooperative games. And that's one of the reasons why I was excited about this game, because my wife, you know, I've talked about it many times on the podcast, she isn't super excited about playing competitive games anymore. And so 99% of the games that we play tend to be cooperative in nature. And one of the things that she said many times is that she misses playing those Euro-style games, right? With, like, you know, like the worker placement and the engine building and all that. You know, she misses Terraforming Mars. She misses, you know, like the Agricola-type games and everything. But mm-hmm. she still has this, like, anxiety playing them because she doesn't, you know, she has a certain amount of anxiety with competitive games. And so I was, you know, always kind of, like, keeping my eyes and ears open for cooperative games that would scratch that itch, and so we decided to take a shot with this. I bought it when it was on sale, and then Jason and I played it with our friend Gabe at Gen Con. So I guess we'll go from there. Jason, do you want to take a stab at describing Atlantis Rising?
I mean, I can.
Do your best.
I don't remember specifically a lot of the mechanics, but what I do remember is the sort of gathering of resources thing, and so there's, I forget how many, like, tentacles there are on the island. I think there's,
six.
Like, seven.
Yeah, peninsulas, okay, yeah.
Yeah, so there's these six, like, branches of the island. They're all kind of, like, it kind of looks like an octopus that's been splayed out.
And that had two legs severed, yes.
Yeah, yes. And then had two legs cut off. And then each of those legs is composed of several independent pieces.
Tiles,
that,
yeah.
Yeah, little tiles that, as certain events happen, will start falling off, starting from the farthest one away from the center. And so your opportunities to gather whatever resource you need from that particular leg of the island become fewer and fewer as time goes on. There are things you can do to sort of prevent that for a while, like stave it off for a bit. So you can create things like a protective barrier around that particular leg that will absorb one of the events that is supposed to make part of it fall off or something like that. And I don't remember. I think there is also like a mechanic where you can like maybe get a tile back from the ocean,
yeah,
or something.
So, yeah. So one of the resources in the game is called Mystic Energy. They're these little like glass beads, and that's the resource that you spend in order to do those two things, along with a couple other things you can do with them. But yeah, you can use it to put down the mystic barriers that basically like prevent against the tile flooding, or you can pay one more than it costs for a mystic barrier in order to flip a tile back over and unflood the tile, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you do that, you have to coordinate with your teammates, to sort of make sure that you get all the appropriate amount and number of, the amount and type of resources you need in order to build the different parts.
Right. There's like four different resources. Well, I guess,
yeah,
it's
I
more
don't
than
remember
that. So there's, we're just going to go through it. This might be boring, but there's crystal, there's gold, then there's ore, and the ore can be taken to another peninsula. Mm. So you get the ore from one peninsula, I believe it's mountains, and then you can take the ore to the Forges Peninsula, where you can then take
like
an action
bars.
To, yes, you transform the ore into Atlantium, which are these little metal bars.
Right.
And yeah, then that is like the sort of the final component that you need between the ore and it.
Yeah.
And it's the only component, or it's the only resource in the game that needs to be transformed into another resource for some reason.
Yeah.
But that's it. So the ore is useless when it comes to creating components or anything else, basically. But you can turn that into Atlantium, which is then one of the four resources that is necessary for creating the components and then the final sort mm-hmm. of portal
yeah.
tile at the end of the game.
So in addition to the, you know, spaces you have to gather these resources eventually sort of disappearing, there's sort of an added hurdle to getting resources, which is that, like, it's not just you go to a space and then you claim the resource. You also have to roll some dice that determine whether or not you can actually pick up a resource, and I
right.
think also how many you can pick up at a time or something like that.
So there's different. So each tile has a certain number of worker placement spots on it. And you, so there's a, like on a tile further out, there's probably fewer spots for it, but like the chance of getting that resource is higher because the die roll necessary is lower. So there's,
right.
you know, there's a higher probability that you will be able to succeed at that action.
But also a higher probability that your worker will sink into the ocean.
Correct. Yeah. And that happens before your workers get to take your action. So this works kind of like a pandemic or, you know, a, Forbidden Island or whatever, where like bad things happen, right? There's like two phases within each round where bad things happen. And so basically there's four parts to a phase. You place all your workers, and then you basically, like, you know, play from the bad things happen deck, right? Flood this peninsula, you know, everybody mm-hmm. loses a worker, you know, everybody loses so much mystic energy, whatever, right? And so you do that, And so what happens is you may have placed your workers on a tile that then floods. They're worthless this round. They don't get to take their action. They come back to your board. So like that happens. And then like you have another part of the round where you choose which tiles to flood, and it becomes an increasing number up to three as the game goes on. And then you just, you know, collect everybody back and, you know, go on to the next round or whatever. Mm-hmm. But so that's what happens. Like that's sort of the rub, right? Is like, if you take the risk of putting workers towards the furthest out tip of the peninsula, you have a better chance at succeeding at that action. And there may be like, you know, I think that with like the library, right, where you get to take the library cards, which not library cards used to check things out, but there's a deck called the library deck that has cards in it. And that's sort of like the deck that has all kinds of fun actions that, you know, that they'll do all kinds of things like place a mystic barrier, unflood a tile. Those are really basic ways. Like they get more complicated than that and more interesting than that. But like that's the deck that you like. There's a whole peninsula just dedicated to that. And you get, I think, like two cards, like if you're on the furthest out peninsula, if it hasn't flooded yet, and then it becomes like one card. But then you get to put the card that you don't take underneath the deck. So you're not milling the deck completely. And then later on, it's like, you know, further in towards the center of the island. Now you're actually discarding the card, so they're out of the game. So like that deck is going to run out faster, you know, things like that. So yeah, like as you get closer in towards the middle of the island, there are certain things that just become less functional, like you get fewer things for it or whatever, right? Yeah.
I mean, it's also true that eventually you may not need one of those one of those legs anymore because you have enough of what you need.
True. But if one of the peninsulas is completely flooded and then that peninsula comes up as something that needs to be flooded again, rather than just flooding one tile, you then have to flood two unflooded tiles on the board. So you want to try to, there's this whole risk reward balance thing going on in all kinds of ways, including trying to keep all peninsulas at least not completely flooded, even if you have exhausted that peninsula for all the resources that you need out of it.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, that's about all I remember about how the game works.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is there anything that I forgot?
Yeah. Well, let me add a couple things, okay? Because there's a couple things because right now it sounds like what we've described is a game that has six peninsulas that all have like six sort of like specific types of worker placement functions, right? And those things just become less functional as the island sinks. But in addition to those six functions, which are like, you know, collect the different resources, convert the one resource into the other, get the library card, and then there's also one that allows you to get more workers, right? Because like in many worker placement games, you can get more workers, and that comes off of one of the, like, it comes off the city peninsula. Right. Mm-hmm. But in addition to those six peninsulas, each one of the components that you're creating has its own function. Some of them are one-time bonuses that you get. Some of them have actual worker placement spots on them. So they kind of add to the number of options available to you as you play the game if you've created those components of the whole machine, right? Mm. So that's one other thing I think that's kind of critical to this game, is that it's not just those six worker placement options available to you on the island. It's also all the things that you're building in the machine, which can be like, you know, up to nine things, right? Now, in the games that I've played, roughly about half of those have all been sort of the, you create this thing, you flip it over, and it has an immediate one-time effect. But about half also have spots for worker placement actions to be taken, you know, which adds a lot of depth and variety to the game, especially because there's like 20 components total, I think, to choose from. Okay, so they have difficulty chart in the game, right, where you can set this up for, like, you know, difficulty 1, difficulty 2, 3, 4, right? And one of the things that you do to increase the difficulty is you take more components from, they have the components categorized A, B, C, D. And the further into the alphabet you get, the more resources are necessary in order to construct those components. So that makes a harder game, right? Because now it takes longer to get the resources necessary to construct those components. But those components also tend to have, like, I think, more powerful effects in the game. So, you know, Jocelyn and I played a level 1 or 2 game. It was one step up from, like, the base level game that you and Gabe and I had played.
Right.
So we played two of those games within the last week or two. And it definitely was a lot harder to construct all the components before the island just completely fell into the ocean. But there were certain actions that really felt very powerful to me that I don't think we saw the first couple times we played the game, including the time that I played with you. Like, there was one action that allowed me to go into the Bad Things Happen deck. I think it's called Misfortunes. And basically, like, I could take out any two basic cards, which are the ones that flood the peninsulas, or any special card, the things that, like, you know, might destroy a built component or whatever, like really bad stuff. And allowed me to basically, like, every round I could go in with one person and get rid of some of those cards from that deck to really kind of make sure that none of the really bad stuff happened, or to decrease the probability that the peninsulas that we were in the worst shape in were going to come up and get flooded even further. Really cool, right? And we didn't see that in the first couple of times we played the game. When you and I played the game, it was very sort of vanilla. We used like the sort of a recommended setup for a first-time game. And it very much just felt like a very straightforward sort of rote, gather these materials, work together to gather the right number of materials for all the components that you need to make, and then go through the process of making those things while still mitigating the failure by trying to build mystic barriers to prevent flooding, unflood tiles that are being flooded, and then, you know, use whatever other methods are available through the library cards or what have you to kind of spread the damage out so that it isn't just getting focused in one spot.
Yeah.
That's kind of how it felt. And I was like, you know, You were pretty excited about the game after we played it. You were like, I think that was the best game that we played at Gen Con. And I was like, cool. And, you know, like my wife Jocelyn was like, yeah, that's really cool. I'm really glad we played that. And I was like, cool. But at the same time, I was sort of like, you know, we got about three quarters of the way through both of those first two games that I played. And I was just counting up the resources and I'm like, we've got it. Like, we've got it in the bag. And so, like, about three quarters of the way through the game, all the tension was just kind of broken for me. Because I was like, I don't think there's any way we're going to lose this. Because now we can just focus on putting all of our resources into mitigating the loss by just getting tons and tons of mystic energy, building gates or building barriers and unfloating tiles and stuff. And as long as we can get through like three rounds, you can math it out. Like, we've got it, right? Like, it takes only so many workers to build a component. We have this many. We can make two components per round, and we need to make like three components, right? So I had it all figured out. But then when we increased the difficulty, things got a lot tighter and a lot more interesting and a lot funner. And so after playing those last two games where we played on the difficulty one step up, now I was like, okay, yeah, that's really cool. You know, like this, the way that this is balanced feels perfect at like, you know, the one step up from the lower difficulty to me at this point. You know, I'm not an expert at the game or anything. We've only played it like four or five times, but that felt like a good challenge, and the different actions that I was getting out of now the randomized tiles, the randomized components, right, for the machine that you're building, when randomizing that rather than just going with that initial suggested setup, it gets a lot more interesting. You know, like, there's a lot more variance in what they do and everything. And so I was way more excited about that after having played it the last two times, I think, than I was the first two times, where I was like, yeah, that was cool. It's nice to have a co-op game to play with somebody that uses worker placement mechanics, but I wasn't like, this game is the next best thing in gaming. Right. And I still don't think I'm quite like there, right? I think it's a very good, better than I thought the first couple times, worker placement co-op game with beautiful art, just absolutely gorgeous art. You know, like, I love Vincent Dutre's art, and so like that's one of the things that hooked me, in addition to the fact that this was a co-op. You know,
I mean, when we played it at Gen Con, my immediate reaction was, this is a good game. This was fun. But I can see how it would get boring really quickly. Like, the replayability of this would not be, you know, it wasn't there for me. So it's good to hear that, you know, if you increase the difficulty, it becomes a little less predictable.
Right. Cause that the game that we played felt very predictable and very controlled in hand. Now, I think there might be a chance that we were only playing three misfortunes cards per round because there were three of us, and I don't think that we checked the modified rules in the back of the book for a three-player game, because it tells you to play two cards for the first player and then one card for the other players. So I think we might have been playing on a little bit extra easy difficulty. But I don't think we did that the first time I played with my wife, and it was kind of the same thing. I think that, like, when you need far fewer resources for the components that you're building, it just goes much faster, and you can get all that work done earlier before, you know, all the misfortunes have snuck up on you and you know, like, trash your island or whatever. So
So
you know, like, that first game we played, it felt very straightforward and very rote. But I think once you increase the difficulty, make it a lot harder to get the number of resources that you need to build all the components. And then also, you know, increase the number of tiles that you're seeing, increase the variance within the functions of those tiles. I think it becomes a much more interesting game. So,
yeah,
Yeah, I think it succeeds pretty well at what it's doing. I think you could still play this enough that you've seen all the different components that you could play with. And, you know, after doing that enough, you'd probably get a little bored with it. So maybe this is a game that needs an expansion at some point. But I think for what it is, the price that it is, because it's very affordable. I think like I got it for like $30 some, and I think I think the retail is like $60, but that's still not that much these days, right? Mm-hmm. And like obviously you can get it on a discount website for like $45 or whatever probably. So I mean it's a pretty good value given the, you know, like the quality of the components are super high, like all of remember the resource the physical components for the resources?
Yeah.
Like, the little metal bars actually feel like little metal bars.
Yeah, they're pretty cool.
They're really neat. You know, and it's got, you know, like, little, like, plastic. Everybody's seen the little plastic pieces that count for the crystals and the gold and all that. They're just those little, like, I don't know, what would you call them? Like, they're just, like, I don't know. They get used for those little red and, I don't know. Like, I've got, I bought a bunch from, like, some hobby store or something, like, you know, like 15 years ago, just to use as like generic components for gaming and stuff. But that's fine. But I mean, the little resin metal bars are really, really neat. But I mean, like, you know, the artwork by Vincent Dutre is just absolutely gorgeous. It really is. And I mean, like the, you know, the board that you use to construct the machine is double layered. So all of the different components slot into it real tightly and like sit there. It's really satisfying nice to touch, put yeah. those. Yeah. And so I just feel like, you know, the island itself, like, you know, kind of goes together like a jigsaw puzzle. It's a really well designed, well manufactured, good looking game. And so for the price, I think it's a great value if you're looking for something that is cooperative and uses sort of like traditional Euro mechanics and isn't just another pandemic. And I mean, it has some pandemic mechanics because it has to, you know, the game has to work against you. So there's like, you know, the misfortunes deck, which is very similar to what happens in Pandemic or Forbidden Island or Forbidden Desert or whatever. Yeah. But the actual mechanic for how you play the game is different from those other games. And I think gives it an identity that is special within the board game space that we, at least that exists right now in 2022.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I'm pretty impressed with this game, and I actually would like to play it some more, actually, to experience some of the things that you were talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know as I would personally buy it, because it has a similar feel to games that I really enjoy playing, like Forbidden Island and the other one, Forbidden Desert. It's not, you know, those games aren't quite as complex as Atlantis Rising.
But, it's a step up from that, but it's similar, right?
Yeah, but they're very similar. So, you know, so I feel like I already have that space covered in my board game collection, but that's not a knock against the game. The game is
It's a good it's point. Good. Yeah. You know, because like I said, one of the reasons why this was particularly special to me was because we were looking for co-op Euro games, right? Yeah. And if you're not averse to playing Euro games with other people and you like playing Euro games with other people, if you don't mind playing competitive ones, then you maybe don't need a co-op Euro game as badly as I do personally, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, in your case, when you want to play a Euro game, you get together with Dave or whoever and you play a Euro game.
Yeah.
And you don't have any difficulty getting that done, right? And you don't have anybody in your life that's saying, I sure wish we could play Euros, but I really hate playing competitive games. So the need for you specifically for this particular game is lower than mine, right? Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean it's a bad game or that you don't enjoy it, but means that, like, there isn't – the necessity of it isn't as high.
Yeah.
But, you know, if it's the sort of thing where you really do prefer co-ops, but you also kind of like Euros, then if you're that person, then this game might be kind of special for you.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other thoughts on Atlantis Rising?
No, other than what we just discussed at the beginning. I'm like, it really shouldn't be called Atlantis Rising now. Yep. That thought is just going to stick with me every time I see it.
Could be Escaping Atlantis. Could be, you know, Atlantis Sinking.
Atlantis Sinking would be the most direct title.
Okay. Well, Jason, if people would like to get a hold of us and let us know, I don't know, the best alternative to living in Atlantis as far as mythological cities go, where would they teleport themselves to if they were going to leave Atlantis? How would they do so?
Does it have to be a mythological city?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I'm putting my foot down.
All right. Well, if you want to let us know that you wish to escape to the lost continent of Mu, you can email us. It's podcast@limitedplaytime.com. You can go to the website, limitedplaytime.com. You can tweet us at limitedplaytime or go to Instagram at limitedplaytimepodcast.
Does Wakanda count? Are we like deep enough into MCU now where like MCU has become mythology?
Yeah, I know.
Or just Marvel, I guess it doesn't have to be MCU. Anyway,
yeah, I would say so, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Okay, all right, so if you want to go to Wakanda too, that works too.
We should also mention the video.
Oh yeah, I did a video. If you listen to the podcast and you'd like to see me for around 7 or 8 minutes talking about a board game on the internet, I have a video on our Limited Playtime channel on YouTube where I talk about Marvel Dice Throne, which is a game we talked about already on the podcast. But if you kind of want to see how it works and, you know, like see my wonderful face, then it's there and you can check it out. And we would love for you to check it out because currently we have very little traction with YouTube since we have very little presence there, but it would be encouraging to have more traction, and it would probably encourage us to do more there because it's pretty discouraging otherwise.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for the reminder, Jason. All right. No thanks problem. For listening, everybody. We will see you in 2 or 3 weeks with something else. We haven't really talked about it, but we'll figure it out. We've got a whole spreadsheet, right? So we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah, later.
Bye.